Group meeting, Sunday, 10th February 1985. All anniversaries are important dates because they stem from the date of birth. And the date of birth is peculiarly important. I wonder how many people realize or even begin to see the fact and appreciate it that the entire cosmos is in action in producing any one person or thing or creature. We are so limited in our outlook and understanding that we see things in terms of separateness and littleness. We don't appreciate the fact that the entire cosmos is in continuous creative action. And that action gives birth to the what we see as separate things or persons in the world. So for that reason, we are, each and every one of us, and each and every thing, be it an atom or a virus, or be it a galaxy, are in continuous relationship with everything else that there is. This total relationship between the particular individual or thing and the total cosmos is something which the human race is just beginning to wake up to. Science has seen that with respect to the cosmos and its constituents as such. But when man begins to see that and is able to appreciate the significance and the implications of that, he will necessarily undergo a considerable change, not only in his thought, in his outlook upon things and upon life, but in his inner consciousness. Merely having an idea, however brilliant, or a thought, however inspiring, is not the whole thing. That is part of something which is immensely deeper, and that is a transformation of consciousness. People sometimes ask, what is the purpose of our existence? Well, it seems to me that one of the main purposes of our individual, separate human existence is so to live that consciousness comes to its culmination in terms of holistic consciousness. This is of the utmost importance, because only in holistic consciousness can mind, the reality which is mind, at its own transcendent level, function freely through us. Everyone talks of my mind, his mind, brilliant mind, and all the rest of it. Only up to a very small degree that is so, even where genius is concerned. Mind comes into play only with holistic consciousness, and holistic consciousness marks all the perfected holy ones that the world has produced so far. We know of the founders of religions, but they are not the only ones who realize this. All the truly great spiritual teachers of whom we have no record, historical record, they too realized this holistic consciousness. And in realizing that, they were able to enable pure mind itself, this transcendent universal energy, form of energy, to function not only through them, but functioning through them to affect their whole environment and their society. I think that is one of the reasons why the teachings of the founders have overflowed the boundaries of the region where they lived and where they taught, and has helped thousands and millions of people to belong to the particular kind of teaching that they gave out. And one extremely important point to notice here is that the kind of teaching they gave out was never a system of philosophy or a particular theology. Because systems of philosophy and theologies emanate from ordinary people, and in the word ordinary I'm including genius too. It is through their thinking process, which is only a logical talking process, that they produce their theologies and philosophies. They see the world of things and the processes of life in the universe and are able to appreciate certain fundamental laws which seem to be governing these processes. And on the basis of some assumption or other, they work out a whole system of philosophy. The most advanced ontologies of the world, and associated with that, the epistemologies which have been produced, are all the result of the ordinary thinking of people, as we are, not of people who had realized holistic consciousness. Those who realized holistic consciousness never produced a philosophy or theology because they well understood its limitations and the possibilities and the extent to which they could be misunderstood and misappreciated. So what they taught was entirely directed towards helping human beings so to live that holistic consciousness would be the final fruit of their life. Holistic consciousness is the culmination of our present consciousness. Now, it is in our day and age, in this very century, and particularly after the last World War, that there are people who are waking up to this fact. And one of the very important things to bear in mind in this connection is the fact that our ordinary consciousness, which functions in terms of the finite and the temporal and therefore the mortal only, becomes free of its limitations and is able to function equally well and be at home in the context of the infinite and the eternal. We have used the words infinity and eternity. But who is conscious in terms of infinity and eternity? People have thought about it. They have put down their thoughts. And all their thoughts are quite inadequate. Because I say so very definitely and positively, because if ever transcendence, or I'd like to use my old phrase, the lightning of transcendence touches you even for an instant, and you get that instantaneous touch with infinity and eternity, you will find that it negates all that is the product of ordinary, finite, temporal thinking. It negates it all. Negates what? Negates it as truth. That is not the supreme truth towards which the human race is slowly evolving. And it is evolving very, very slowly. It's taken approximately 2 million years to come to this stage, which is a very minor stage, really. But it is a stage, and it is the stepping stone, especially in this century, towards the culmination of which is holistic consciousness. So, whilst the consciousness, being actually conscious in terms of infinity and eternity, negates all that we are conscious of in our terms of the finite and the temporal, it does not destroy this, because this has its place in the whole scheme of things. It's a necessary place. We are sort of emerging out of infancy, as far as our consciousness is concerned, just emerging out of it. And the transcendent will never destroy anything. So whilst holistic consciousness negates what our finite and temporal consciousness has produced, it doesn't destroy it. Because if it did destroy it, there'd be no survival possible. We'd all perish. So many creatures, the whole of the animal world, for instance, is practically all the human world too, being in this limited state, if its consciousness was destroyed, then the person himself would die. So everything would die off. Of course, everything may die off if man is sufficiently stupid and criminally stupid, as we know too well today. Therefore, whilst the transcendent negates that which is still the limited and the non-transcendent, it does not destroy it. And it's not destroying it means particularly that there is this which we call transcendent love and transcendent wisdom, which underlies the whole evolutionary process. Now, all this in relation to the fact that one's birth is of such, the day of one's birth is of such importance. If we can begin to see a good many of the implications involved here, then we would begin to value life in the right way. We say life is sacred, but we don't know the meaning of the sacred. We don't really know the meaning. Life is truly sacred, but in a manner and a way of which we really are unaware. So whilst we may pay lip service to the statement that life is sacred, our actual living process throughout the ages has not been such which confirms that statement. So this is one of our particular tasks, to realize the sacredness of life. You see how important each thing is. There's the smallest little insect and the greatest genius. The whole cosmos has conspired together to produce this. So there is a complete relationship. So if you ever feel depressed, oh, what is the use of me? I can't do this, I can't do the other. I'm only a burden here or a nuisance there and so forth. Put all that absolutely aside. You are of infinite worth in actuality, although that actuality is veiled, is hidden over, is even besmirched by our present folly due to our present state of ignorance. You see, there is no one in the whole cosmos like you, like any one of you, or me, or a mosquito, or an ant. They're all wonderful. They are the product of the activity of the primordial creative energy, the origin of the totality. Now, I want to talk of something else. Professor King has written the foreword for the third book. I've seen it. It's rather a eulogistic foreword, but I don't think it is altogether inaccurate. And in it, he mentions the fact that ever since early Indian religious thought came out, that was in 1956, he has used that book, my first one, for teaching his students in West and East Africa and in India, and since 1968 in California. He is, as you, most of you probably know, professor of comparative religion and the history of religion in the University of California. And in the foreword, he also mentions that it has proved so useful to his students. Then he goes on to say that when The Heart of Religion came out in 1976, it was a real godsend to all his students. You will see this in the foreword of my third book on Zarathustra. And it inspired their thinking and their study, their research work. At that period, soon after 1976, he had a group of students who were working for their PhD in religious studies and so on, you see. And they found it extremely useful. But in his personal letter to me, he says that it would be very good if I were to expound the significances and the implications which are only suggested by all that has been written in this book. He says it abounds in original thinking. Of course, he has to use the word thinking. But parts of it really are a revelation. And so much so that one of the reviewers of the book, years ago, right in the beginning when it first came out, wrote, "It is a scripture of great beauty." And since Professor King has been very encouraging and has helped me to sort of go on with this work, I thought it might be useful now to start looking at in to go into this book, and all of us study it together. Is that agreeable to you? Of course, someone may say, "Oh, but I've got the book, I can read it." But never forget, whenever I read a book, I read it limited by all my conditioning. Very few people understand that. They read a book, and if they see a few things with which they agree, then they say, "Ah, it's a good book, that's right." And if they disagree, they say, "Oh, it's no good, that book. I disagree with all that he said," you see, and so forth. So the significances and the implications can come out in slow study, a very slow study. So let's start at the very beginning. Whenever the creative activity of the spirit effectively meets the urgency of the human situation, there is a true renewal for all who are quickened by it. What is this creative activity of the spirit? We use the words spirit and matter. And what do they stand for? For all these centuries, right up to the end of last century, spirit and matter, mind and body, were regarded as two entirely separate things. And in fact, the philosopher John Locke, who was one of our distinguished philosophers, who was very much influenced by Newton's presentation of the atomic theory, declared that the mind is a mental atom, entirely separate from all other atoms, by analogy with physical atoms. And he declared, therefore, and I think John Stuart Mill or Jeremy Bentham perhaps took that idea and said that the purpose of existence for each person was to fulfill his own ambitions and do the best for himself, unconcerned with anybody else. He could ride roughshod over them. Two such distinguished philosophers, like Fichte and Hegel in Germany, also produced magnificent systems of thought, but they were cloud palaces of thought. And they brought out the idea, the same sort of idea, that it was the business of the great ego to ride roughshod over everything that obstructed his view and understanding of things. Now, actually, those words, spirit and matter, stand for the concretest, the subtlest, and the concretest expression of the primordial, undifferentiated, creative energy. Now, I use the word energy because we live in a scientific age in which the word energy really plays perhaps the most important part. But this, when I use the word energy, it is not confined to energy as known to science as such up to date, but to the origin itself. But it's convenient to use the word energy with respect to the origin of all things, of everything, because it is a word which is not so heavily loaded and misunderstood as a word like God or Brahman or Atma or Ahura Mazda or any such thing. As you know, all the God conceptions which the human race has produced are only one self apotheosized, that is all. people have presented God in their own image, cutting out all that they didn't like about themselves, the vices and the nasty things in our life and so forth. They cut that out and put all the good things in and said that God is all this in superlative measure. So, but they are hopelessly mistaken. The founders of the religions themselves gave hints pretty strongly. You'll find some remarkable statements in the Old Testament. I quoted them some months ago at one of our meetings, you see. And in Zarathustrian teaching too, that the Supreme Being, as they talked of, you see, was responsible for both good and evil. And that is a fact in so many, it's there in so many words as such. Sri Krishna gives perhaps the least inadequate and the least misleading statement of the Supreme when he talks about himself, when Arjuna asks him to reveal his own nature to the disciple. And there you will find that he includes everything. See, this is a curious fact. To give you just one example, he says, "I am the gambling of the cheat, and I am the splendor of splendid things." He also says, "Death am I, and the origin of all things to come." You see, now there the writer of the Gita dared to give out the whole truth, so to say, in making such statements. Of course, knowing what human beings are like, he also put all the jam into it, and all the nice things, the marvelous things of the divine, all those are there, and just a few statements like this indicating the not nice things. And then when he finally tells Arjuna, "Thy duty is to fight and slay thy foes, they are already slain by me." Now that's a wonderful thing to meditate upon. The Lord himself has slain. Well, in the Old Testament you find, I forget now. It's in the books, the first five books. "And 3,000 of them were slain, those who had gone against the teachings of Moses," you see, and so forth, on the battlefield. So, this primordial creative energy, its subtlest expression is what we call spirit. Its concretest expression is what we call matter. Now, this first sentence says that the creative activity of the spirit, whenever it meets the urgency of the human situation, there is a true renewal for all who are quickened by it. You know the meaning of the word quickened. We have the English phrase "the quick and the dead." We also know the fact that after a certain number of months, the fetus in the womb is quickened. It comes to life. It comes to a new state of being, a transformed state of being, actually. See, all right. So now, the urgency of the human situation. Time and again, thousands and thousands of people through the centuries who have, through their personal experience and their personal conditions, inquired, what is the meaning of all this? Why is there so much suffering, so much trouble? Why are there so many mistakes made, and so forth? And they have been serious enough to appreciate the urgency of their demand. That's on the individual scale. On the national scale, we find in the history of the founders of the religions and also of several of the truly great spiritual teachers that the whole of society and the conditions, the political, economic, and other conditions where they lived had become so intolerable that something had to happen in order that a renewal might take place and they were not altogether destroyed. So there is an urgency of the human situation, both with respect to the individual and with respect to society. And when the individual and or society turns towards a power which will bring about renewal and enlightenment and understanding of how to live, then this energy, which is the creative energy which we call spirit, responds. It doesn't respond in the way that a human being responds. That is to say, if I say, please do this for me, and you say, oh yes, I will do this for you, and you do it excellently well, you see, and so forth. Not that way. But our activity, because we are part and parcel of transcendence itself, an integral part and parcel, nothing can destroy that fact, however evilly we may live. Because we are part and parcel of transcendence itself, we evoke that energy through our own, shall I say, prayer, through our own aspiration, through the sadness or the horribleness of our own particular condition and so forth. And it stirs up that transcendent aspect of the creative energy to start functioning in oneself. And the same applies to the human human society as a whole. So, this meeting of that creative energy with the human being and the human situation produces a renewal. But what sort of a renewal is this? Where does it begin? How does it proceed? What is its objective? It touches human consciousness. You may have a brilliant idea, but a brilliant idea is not the supreme thing. When you become truly conscious of something at its own transcendent level, then that consciousness affects, completely transforms your whole thinking, feeling, speaking, and acting. Thought, feeling, speech, and action express that invisible, indestructible thing which is consciousness, pure consciousness in itself. Pure consciousness and pure being, ultimate being, ultimate reality, are an identity. Being and consciousness are only different ways of functioning of that ultimate reality. Just as mind and matter are just different modes of functioning of that ultimate reality. But it is a unitary whole. The whole thing is a unitary whole. So this transformation takes place in one's own consciousness, which affects the whole of the expression of that consciousness in our everyday life in terms of thought, feeling, speech, and action. That is the only solution to any and every problem. I'm not presenting a panacea. When we try to produce something which we believe as a system of thought or a technique or a particular procedure, and say that this will solve all the problems of the nation, we are presenting panaceas, but they always fail, because whatsoever thought produces ultimately has all the limitations of the man who thought. It is not perfection. Never is. Did you listen on TV today to Powell and Scargill arguing about the cause? Most instructive of what I'm saying, actually. You would see it in operation. And this has happened throughout history. So the transformation of consciousness takes place, and in that transformation there is the real quickening. Because the human being, the word human means happy creator. And happy creator is identical with God. We say God is in bliss, in heaven, everlastingly. And God is the creator. But as I said, I'm not using the word God because it is so heavily loaded. So this transformation of consciousness takes place, and oneself is quickened. One's whole life becomes changed thereby. We may not notice that change. We may say that one day I had such and such an experience, which one thinks is this touch with transcendence. I have heard in past years, particularly during the 1950s, when several of the spiritual and religious societies in this country had their conferences, and they used to invite me to give a talk and so forth, and I used to listen to them. And I'll never forget how some of them actually stood up and very charmingly and in a childlike manner said, "I have spoken with God. God has spoken to me." And when the inquiry was made, "What did he tell you?" Well, it was just a few simple little common sense things which this man spoke. That is all. For one thing, God doesn't speak English, nor any other language. The language of God is revelation. It's the effect of that transcendent energy upon the living organism and the consciousness that works through it. And when that energy touches that consciousness, it is in terms of revelation. And revelation in its actuality can never be put into words that present the whole of revelation. Because revelation belongs to the context of the infinite and the eternal, not to the context of the finite and temporal. So they become new men and usher in a new age. And that has happened with the founders of the great religions. They were the new men, and they did usher in a new age, each and every one of them. Such were Lao Tzu, Krishna, the Buddha, Zarathustra, Moses, Jesus. I have included Muhammad here, but this was written in 1974. And I would rather hesitate to include Muhammad, because I have had opportunity to study the Quran a little bit during these years, which I had not looked into before. And he said so many things which anyone who really had holistic consciousness would never have said. Because such sayings have been responsible for terrible wars, cruelty, oppression, and backwardness. Look at Islamic law today. It's extraordinary short-sightedness in so many respects, and it's cruelty, and so forth. But where the great Sufi mystics were concerned, and they emerged out of Islam, of course, they produced the supreme thing, and no doubt about that. There was no exclusiveness about them. They had the real inclusiveness which characterizes holistic consciousness. But the Quran itself is very, very exclusive. And similar things have happened in relation to Christianity. The followers later on brought about this exclusiveness. There is no salvation for you except through Jesus Christ and so forth. You can be a damnable sinner, as damnable as you please, but if you believe in the Lord Jesus Christ at the very end of your life and repent, you will go upstairs, not downstairs. Now you see, this is all sheer idiocy. People right up to now have never realized that after the death of the organism, there is no more an identifiable entity which was named John Brown or Mary Smith. That's absolutely gone. That I am I consciousness, which comes into being shortly after birth and is lost in our sleep. Even in our sleep, we don't know that I am I. And when this organism is dead, is completely disintegrated, that I am I consciousness has disappeared with it altogether. There is no such thing as a particular, separate, immortal soul or mind or spirit as an entity which survives the death of the organism. The organism is the whole thing. In some moment of remarkable inspiration, somebody was the first to state that the man is a microcosm representing the macrocosm, the totality. The totality the totality is embodied in the living organism. It's very difficult to see that, but it is so. The whole of infinity, the whole of eternity, transcendence itself, as I've said 1,000 times, I think, during these last few years, is embodied in this organism as such. But because we inherit a brain which started its evolution way back from the reptiles 600 million years ago, you see, because we have this as an instrument for controlling the organism and directing it, we have those characteristics which deny transcendence, which set themselves up against the reality. So now, each of the teachers made the needed response to his own unique situation and communicated religious truth in a form which was outstandingly marked by its originality. I think we'll stop there today. That's just the first paragraph.